senior multi-faith educator at Global Spiritual Life at NYU, and you are listening to Multi-Faithful, the podcast about religious diversity, multi-faith dialogue, and effing the ineffable. On this week's podcast, we are joined by someone who needs no introduction, president of NYU, John Sexton, a scholar of religion and a long-standing leader in the field of higher education. He discusses with us his thoughts on religion, spirituality, and higher education, and how we can make our universities ecumenical and open to people of all religious persuasions. Thank you for tuning in to Multifaithful, and now to this week's conversation. I am joined today by the NYU president, John Sexton, author of Baseball as a Road to God and fan of sports and religion. Should be an interesting conversation today. And as for our student today, we are joined by Hannah Leffingwell. Hannah, can you introduce yourself?
My name is Hannah Leffingwell. I'm a graduate student in the Institute of French Studies at NYU, and I just joined the Global Spiritual Life office, and I'm really excited to be here.
So, John, I know right before we started recording, we were talking about the cosmic sequence of events that has led us to the Mets and the Cubs playing in the National League Championship Series. And so I'm curious whether this is maybe indicative of proof of your course, baseball, as a road to God. And maybe how this is a spiritual moment in the history of Major League Baseball.
So, as you know, having been associated with the course in multiple ways, Ariel, this course is designed to give students a different lens into religion by taking something they wouldn't ordinarily think about as religion and showing how, for some, it could display all of the characteristics of religion that Mircea Eliade and Rudolf Otto and William James and other serious students of religion ascribe to the religious experience. And it's remarkable how it works, because just this morning I got an email from an extraordinary man, one of the cognoscenti, one of the intelligentsia in American society, literally the spokesperson for American higher education in his professional capacity. And he was felling, although he's a Christian, ecumenical here, he was quelling about the miracle that he saw in the fact that, against all odds, here, as of last night, we have a playoff coming up between the Cubs, who've not won the World Series in over 100 years, and the Mets, who have not won the World Series since 1986, which, of course, to New Yorkers who live in such immediacy and hyperstimulation, feels like 100 years.
Also, one could make the case that the Mets have had enough follies in those 20 years to compensate for 100.
Right, this is true. So, and this, you know, especially as one approaches religion where, you know, the 7 days of creation may have been a billion, you know, calendar years, you know, what does time mean? So, but this member of the of society highbrow says to me, this is a miracle, and you should probably revise the curriculum to incorporate this, because in his theory it was all connected. He was being facetious, of course, I hope. It was connected to the visit to the United States of the Pope and the fact that here the United States is visited, and in this moment in the American game, these two great miracles occur simultaneously. So there's a grand convergence. And I wrote back pointing out to him how quickly he had embraced the notion that a miracle was present, with which I have no difficulty at all, because people create their own miracles. This is what Eliade and Otto teach us, that what I see as sacred may not be what you see as sacred. Indeed, I can't prove to you that it's sacred. And this occurs all over the world. As I walk through the outback of Australia with a native Australian toward the great monument, natural monument of Uluru, he, of course, sees it as Axis Mundi, the connection between this world and the world of the transcendent. I see it as a beautiful natural wonder arising out of the flat earth, that wonderful monolithic orange mound. But on the other hand, if I were ordained, and in the moment of natural wonder for me, paused and took out of a little box I was carrying a chalice and a host and some wine, and I said the words of consecration, to me that would be a deeply sacred moment. But to him, it would be lunchtime. So we create our sacrality, and that is a good thing, because for each of us it puts us in touch with the transcendent. But there's a difference between, as I wrote back to my friend this morning, there's a difference between seeing the wonder and the miracle and the epiphany or hierophany of the moment in the Cubs and the Mets coming together, and immediately running to the fact that that brings us to an anthropomorphic interventionist God. One needn't go that far. One needn't go that far. And indeed, many modern theologians would resist going that far. So in this wonder of the Cubs and the Mets, there are many lessons, it turns out, about religion, if one can use the tools of religion to analyze it and then transport the ideas that you take from that one example to the way we approach religion. And there are warnings, for example, in the story I just told, against religious triumphalism, which of course is very much in the spirit of the Of Many Institute here at NYU, warnings against triumphalism. And that's why the course is entitled Baseball as a Road to God and not Baseball as the Road to God.
Is there any chance that if the Cubs win the World Series that there will not be triumphalism from Cubs fans?
I don't know if you've noticed this, but occasionally, even in the great religions of the world, triumphalism creeps in.
Occasionally.
I mean, you know, we've fought wars, right? We are fighting wars today.
We are.
That are spawned by a religious triumphalism. And this, of course, is part of the danger of allowing triumphalism to creep in to our spiritual life. Because we then feel a need to diminish those who have other roads to the mansion, or are in other rooms in the mansion, to carry the metaphor from the Bible out, instead of embracing the fact that if I understand, I mean, you and I come from different religious traditions, even though yours is the one embraced by everyone else in my family other than me, since everyone in my family, my immediate family other than me, is Jewish. But there's a way to approach that. You know, how did you guys miss the arrival of the big guy? You know, or there's a way in to approach that and saying, wow, isn't it wonderful that we both can touch the transcendent? My children every Sabbath and in the high holidays in their way, and me in the Eucharist. And what can we learn about the fact that we each approach the spiritual dimension differently? But triumphalism is a real danger, as we see.
I've heard you use the word ecumenical a lot to describe NYU, actually, as an ecumenical university. And I know that that is a word that comes from the Christian tradition, but as I think in pluralistic settings, gets used increasingly. And I was curious if maybe you could unpack that term for us a little bit and kind of explain why ecumenism provides such a good framework for understanding how we're balancing so many competing and different religious or spiritual interests in a broader, big global university.
There's a great man, a great figure in American law. He's a judge today, but he's considered by many of us one of the greatest educators of the last 50 years. His name is Guido Calabresi, and he was the dean of Yale Law School for a long time. And just last night, I was with him at the Thomas More Center at Yale, giving the Calabresi lecture, which they've named for him there. And the title was The Modern Secular University as an Ecumenical Instrument. And I started by telling a story about how in 1956, in a classroom in Brooklyn, a brilliant and progressive man, a Jesuit priest, wrote on the blackboard the words, extra ecclesia nulla salus, outside the church there's no salvation. And I was 14, and I went up to him after class, and I said, Father, does that mean that that my best friend Jerry Epstein will not go to heaven? And he said to me, if you do not baptize him, he will not go to heaven. And the church was still teaching about this place called Limbo, to which good non-Catholics, I didn't say non-Christians, non-Catholics, so Anglicans, you know, Congregationalists, went. They never quite made it to heaven. They stayed in this limbo. And then, happily for me and for people like me, came along this man, John the 23rd. And my 4 years of college were four of the 5 years of the Vatican Council. His papacy was only 5 years long. And then I started to study for my doctorate in religion. And the man with whom I began to study, my mentor for my PhD thesis, was at the time the leading expert on St. Anselm, a single medieval Christian theologian. That was 1963. By 1983, I was now here at NYU Law School. I'd been here 2 years as a young professor. And I was invited to the United Nations for the publication of my mentor's 60-volume work on world spirituality, which contained 25 faith traditions. So that migration that he took from St. Anselm to 25 faith traditions, and the way they presented different ways to look at the transcendent religious experience, without giving up his own faith, you know, just embracing the richness of viewing the world not through the single window that you're given at birth, but through the many facets of a diamond, and embracing the wonder of creation. That intellectual move, it seemed to me, was a critical intellectual move. Now, the story I've just told is that move within theology or within the study of religion. But one can take that out of that context and look at it in the context of other, what I'll call, perspective-creating devices that humankind has, be it nationalism or ethnicity or life experience or whatever. And there's an intellectual move to be made, where you move from viewing things simply from your own vantage point, but you stretch to incorporate viewpoints, especially viewpoints that are dramatically different from your own. So take just one simple example. I don't know if this has occurred to you, but China, I'm going to mix a baseball metaphor in here for you. China is about to come to bat for the third time when no other culture has gotten to bat for a second time as a dominant world culture. Right? You know, the French have had their turn, the British have had their turn, the Americans have had their turn, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it tends to have been a single turn, whereas China's about to come to bat for the third time. You know? Now, we must have a lot to learn from that culture, whatever has brought them to that point, which, you know, those that take a view of them that's more on the positive spectrum would talk about, you know, the importance of collectivity and, you know, family and so forth. Now, we all know, precisely on the point we're talking about, collectivity can create a negative side, too. You know, what do we have to learn from this culture, both spiritually, but also just as a progressive social doctrine? You know, do we want to create a world where, if we succeed in advancing humanity, we would do so by homogenizing everybody into some kind of Esperanto, which, you know, there was once a movement for a language called Esperanto. it became unnecessary because English became so hegemonic. Mm-hmm. But do we want the homogeneity that used to be evoked by the words melting pot in the United States? Or do we want to embrace the notion that we're moving to is a second axial age, as Jaspers would refer to it, which is a community of communities? And I think that this the notion of ecumenism has tremendous power in a secular sense when you begin to view it as the building of a community of communities, and that basic mindset being transported into a kind of social and cultural and political standpoint. So, and that, I think, by the way, is the story behind that we began to tell 15 years ago, that behind New York as the first ecumenical city, because New York has a neighborhood for every country in the world, populated by people who were born in that country. So you can encounter the language, the prayers, the food, the music of every country in the world by getting on the subway. And yet, those people, when you get to those neighborhoods, think of themselves as New Yorkers. So they don't just think of themselves as, you know, as my people would, Irish, right? We're New Yorkers of Irish descent. And that's remarkable in a city where 40% of the citizens of the city were born outside the United States, is that we managed to operate as a community of communities. Not perfectly, but it's an adumbration, a foreshadowing of what the world could be. Now, many would say, yeah, what a fool you are. You know, how quixotic of you that is. And my response is, look, this is Pascal's wager. If we bet against the possibility of that world, it's never going to happen. If, on the other hand, great universities embrace it, so I refer to NYU as the first ecumenical university because of the Global Network University. And that's the theory behind the Global Network University, which is nothing but an extrapolation of New York. Because if you're not a triumphalist and you embrace the joy and richness of getting on the subway and going out to whatever the national pod is, then it would occur to you immediately, well, yes, but these people have come to us and are meeting us on our terms. Isn't the next logical step study away sites that allow our students to encounter them on their terms? Isn't that the next expansive step in this kind of ecumenical move? So it all kind of connects for me.
It's really interesting that you bring up this idea of pluralism. I've been thinking a lot about this in the context of France, because that's what I'm studying. And like you said, understanding culture through comparison is really valuable. And something that's been surprising and interesting to learn is the extent to which the French tradition embraces universalism. The idea that there's an abstract citizen with no identity, no religious identity, no sexual identity, and that's how the country is formed. So we have the secularization in France that the world has more or less learned about through various scandals or controversies. For example, the wearing of the headscarf in French public schools, which was a cause of a lot of unrest in France, and still is a cause of unrest. And that's a totally different model that we see from the American model. And when you compare those, I think it's really powerful, because we're looking at two different forms of democracy and two different ways of understanding multiple identities within a national context. So I think it's fascinating to think about the ways in which you can learn from different places, but there is something to be said for this, and it's not a perfect system, but there's something to be said for a commitment, I think, to pluralism in the United States. And when the United States was founded, it was because people weren't having the freedoms of religion that they wanted and needed, and they came here. And so I think that's foundational. But my question, I guess, is for my generation, we were talking about this earlier, for this younger generation that's now kind of coming into this world and is often less religious or less institutionally religious, how is that community going to look without the kind of structures of traditional religion?
So I have a very difficult task on October the 27th. Somehow, some of the students here convinced me that because it was important, and I accept this completely, because it was important to create a community here at NYU where there could be a genuine contest of ideas at a serious level with the kind of iterative, deepening conversation that occurs, to my mind, in the best of competitive, traditional competitive debate, and they knew my connection to debate, they've constructed a forum where a faculty member and a student debate two students on an issue of interest. And they thought it might catch some interest for this, for me to be the faculty member. And we then wrestled with what topic might be a good topic and one that would kind of disadvantage me sufficiently. So on October the 27th, I'll be engaged in the first of these debates. And the topic is resolved that organized religion can be and is, on balance, a positive force in society, which in these days, given some of what's going on in the world, is not the easiest proposition. You know, these are not the times of the ministers leading the civil rights marches in the South or the anti-war movement. I thought it was very interesting that, as you asked your question, Hannah, you moved quickly to add the adjective institutional religion. And I think that your awareness, as shown by that quick move intellectually, reveals that the behind the move, there's an important moment where students, or the young, this generation you talk about, can move to embrace a spirituality and the importance of a spiritual dimension without taking the next step to institutional religion. And of course, I think that's a very, very important point. And there's a point at which I'd be quite satisfied with the elevation in the consciousness of our students and society of the spiritual dimension. Whether they choose to find that spiritual dimension in an institutional religion, one of the great faiths, or even one of the mega churches, which, you know, there's a phenomena out there, not necessarily dominant among the cognoscenti and the intelligentsia with whom we associate, you know, here in New York City at New York University, indeed quite downstream in terms of its in those circles, but there is a phenomena of a growing religiosity that's not associated with the traditional institutional religions. And it's not just confined to the United States. So my first call, and it's a call that I find in the Baseballers' A Road to God class, which, granted, is a self-selected group. I mean, they've chosen to take the course, so they've shown some predicate interest, usually in the God part rather than the baseball part, right? The number of people that take that course that have never been to a baseball game is startling to me. Yeah, I'd say it's a majority of students that take the course.
And of course, that's no longer true by the end of the course.
Yeah, well, I take them to a baseball game because some of them never have been there, can't see it, you know. The lesson of the course is that thinking, living slow, you know, in this modern time of hyperstimulation, creating contemplative moments, creating moments of detachment, can heighten one's awareness of the small things that are wondrous. And one can find then spirituality in those dimensions. And of course, baseball is a sport that, if you come to understand it well, you must understand the small. You must understand the details. It's not actually a slow sport, as the surface examination of it would cause people to believe. There's an enormous amount of action that happens between the action. And developing the skill of seeing between the lines then gives you a skill that you can transport, you know, by visiting the Grand Canyon, by going to Uluru, by, you know, in other contexts, into a spirituality. So the first step that I would make along the lines of answering your question is that I think that for students in the emerging generation, and for others in the emerging generation, probably more prevalent among others than among students, this phenomenon we talked about, I think the call of the spiritual is an important call that goes to many things that lead ultimately to life happiness. Now, the next step is the call to institutional religions to become part of that process. And I think Pope Francis is a good example of the response, or at least a possible response, of a great faith to that call. You know, is the future of the church presenting itself? I'm now talking about the Catholic Church, my church. Is the future of the church presenting itself as a set of kind of intellectualized dogma that are designed to express in cognitive terms a particular version of the spiritual reality of the glory of the redemptive power of the story of Jesus? You know, are we going to get into battles over, you know, transignification versus transubstantiation? Is this going to be the high war? Or are we going to get down to the experiential mission of the church? So what does a commitment to life mean? What does a commitment to an agapeic, a life of giving love mean? In terms of our obligations to the poor, in terms of our obligations to the planet, the experience of the manifestation of ultimate love that the story of Jesus connotes. Okay, or are we going to get caught up in these dogmatic wars? You know, so the question is, when you add the adjective institutional, what have you added? Have you added the Apostles' Creed, or have you added the experiential mission of the lesson of Jesus as captured in the liturgy? And can the liturgy come alive for people who are seeking this spiritual dimension? So that's a challenge to the institutional religions, and some of them will. You know, I think it's unlikely that those who seek the caliphate, as ISIS does, are going to come to an ecumenical view of the world. But I think I have hope now, for the first time in decades, that the Catholic Church may. I mean, in my view, and this, remember, I'm not a triumphalist, so I don't command others to accept my view, but in my view, the church has strayed over the last decades from the mission of ecumenism. But I think I see a return in Francis to that.
Thank you for listening to part one of our interview with NYU President John Sexton on the Multifaithful podcast. Part two will be coming out next week. Hopefully we will hear more interesting insights and tidbits on the university from President Sexton then. Special thank you to Brian Young for producing and editing the podcast, and to Liz Suados for her music from the film Of Many. Thank you to Hannah for joining me as a student interviewer, and you will hear from her again next week. as we continue the interview. Please rate and review Multifaithful on iTunes. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please email us at spiritual.life@nyu.edu. Thank you for listening to Multifaithful. We'll see you again next week for part two.